Hey, welcome to the Game Changer podcast. I'm excited for another episode here. I've got a friend of mine, a leader right here in our city, somebody who has such a unique journey and story that I'm excited for you guys to hear. I got Raj Lula here with us. Raj, thanks for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Man, excited to just dive into your story and eventually talk about a project you've got going on. But I'd love to start just kind of with your story in the beginning. And, you know, if you're listening online or wherever you're listening, you're not getting the visual that we have, you know, describe where you're from and just your cultural background and just kind of your a little bit of your upbringing.
Yeah. So I'm from Omaha originally, although born in Kansas City, but spent most of my life here. My dad is from India. My mom is from the States. She's white. My dad is a practicing Hindu, and my mom is a Christian. She has been my whole life. So kind of grew up with both sides of that in my world, though we were in church every Sunday. And, you know, but we got both sides of that, you know, kind of upbringing. And when I was in high school, I felt called to ministry. I went to Bible college and I did that for the first 10 years of my career, ministry nonprofit. And then at the end of that, ministry had not really worked out super great, like definitely not the way that I'd planned. I'd planned to be in it for 40 years and, you know, kind of retire or die in it. And and after 10 years, I'd had 7 jobs. Part of that was the recession of 08. Part of that was just not really understanding where the right fit was or what the path looked like for me. And so about 10 years ago, I switched into the creative work side. I had, in pretty much every church role or ministry role that I've ever been in, had been on the creative side of things. I started out in music and I was always just kind of the young guy in staff doing websites and Facebook pages and all those kinds of things. And my last job in nonprofit was the one that kind of put all those skills together. It was, I was communications director at a Christian college. And I was like, wait, all the stuff that other people have been asking me to do as like side work from my job, I can do as just one whole job. And for me, that was the tipping point into just doing creative work for a living. I'm now the co-owner of Fruitful Design and Strategy here in Omaha. And I've been working with my great business partner, Ben Luters, doing that. I was actually a client of his first and then came on as a partner about 7 years ago.
Okay. Yeah, I want to talk about Fruitful because I know we've done some work together. You guys have been through a lot over the last, you know, 7 years together and just even some of your shifts recently. But, you know, going back to your upbringing, your mom's a Christian, your dad a practicing Hindu. You said you were at church every Sunday. Was that, you know, a Christian church with your mom, and was your dad a part of that, or did they kind of operate in two different lanes when it came to kind of their belief system?
Yeah, it was pretty different lanes. We were in Christian churches, specifically mostly white evangelical churches, which is a part of my whole story as well. You know, from I think literally the week that I was born, the way that my mom tells the story, and my dad's influence was more subtle. It was more, you know, bedtime stories that, you know, telling like Indian folk tales or even just the principles of living a life that, you know, is trying to essentially have good karma. And so it was pretty separate, but it is worth knowing that in Hinduism, you have kind of 3 major branches, at least the way my dad describes it. You have what's, you know, considered to be sort of orthodox Hindu. And those are people who, you know, follow by traditional Hindu beliefs. You have, I might mess it up here, reform Hindus who are like, or no, you have liberal Hindus who are more, you know, just open than that. And then you have reform Hindus who are even more liberal than that. And so if you've ever heard the idea that like all paths lead the same place, or, you know, we're all pouring out the same jug of water and that kind of thing, that's very much what a reform Hindu ideas like, and I believe that's the branch that my dad is in. So he didn't have a huge problem with us practicing Christianity because he just saw it as a, you know, path to the same thing.
No, that's interesting. I mean, it sounds like though you knew at a young age you wanted to follow you know, follow Christ, follow church ministry at some level. What was it that in that upbringing that really, you know, gave you the conviction that this is the direction that I want to go for my life?
Yeah. You know, interestingly, I probably 10 years ago, I would have told this story differently and thought that, you know, yes, that there was a strong calling and all of those things. I think now that there was a lot of natural gifting in especially like creative and communicating arts that I was really drawn to. We had an amazing senior pastor. His name is David Haynes, and is arguably one of the best preachers I've ever heard.
Wow.
And it almost poetic with his words. And I just thought that that's how every pastor was, that they cared that much about their writing, that they would quote Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and all that in every sermon, because I just, that was the only exposure I really had.
Yeah.
And then I had a great worship pastor as well. His name was Tommy White. And he taught me several different instruments. I learned how to play guitar, bass, and drums all in that church for free, never paid a dollar for music lessons for those things. And so my exposure to ministry, to that environment, was highly relational and it was highly creative. And, you know, so now I would probably say that I was actually probably being more exposed to the creative side of ministry than necessarily the leadership side or any of those things. David always was kind of allergic to some of the church growth fads that existed. Didn't want to grow a big church. He wanted to have a deeper church. And so I, to me, that those things that were kind of tied together of, of the sense of spirituality and creativity.
I love that you said that. I think about, you know, a musician or an artist, a singer who says they grew up in the church and that's kind of the platform where they grew their gift and then took it beyond just that church. And so it sounds like for you, the platform and then having visuals, models in front of you that were operating in kind of that creative realm and communication in art really drew you to kind of understand and probably what was inside of you and learning what kind of how God created you and the gifts that God had given you. And so you kind of follow that path into ministry, probably very, like you said, consistent with more of your gift mix and just kind of the art forms, not just, you know, pursuing the leadership side or, you know, wanting to lean into helping people grow in a specific area. And then I love your journey too, because you say you had all these different jobs and roles. And I think knowing you, you're very entrepreneurial and that can either come out for some people in a lot of different work. It can come out in a lot of ideas. Talk about that journey of having a lot of different roles, kind of learning more about yourself as you entered into kind of this next phase with Fruitful.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a bunch of different mind map things that you can do. There, Patterson thinking wavelengths is one of my favorite ways to think about that. You basically have people who range from really detail oriented to really big picture. Working genius is another, you know, personality type that, that gives you an idea of how you fit in those things. Unfortunately, I didn't discover those things until well after I'd spent 10 years kind of grinding it out. But both of those things kind of confirm that, like, I'm a really big picture guy. I'm very creative. And my last boss that I ever had besides myself, at least so far, was a guy named Dave Miller. And he was like, look, churches only need one of you and in very small doses.
Yeah.
And that matched up so well with my experience in ministry, was that I had a lot of strategic drive, and most churches, you know, I think it's helpful for people to kind of separate the idea of a church as a spiritual institution and churches as essentially 501c3 nonprofit organizations. So, you know, the building that you go to, the brand name that you go to on any given Sunday morning is two things at every given time. It is both a place of spiritual practice that could meet anywhere. It could be outdoors. It could be, you know, those, that group of people trying to do that thing together can, it, is not at all constrained by the name of the church or any of that. Yeah. but the operations of that place, who makes sure that there are chairs and who organizes the band and who, you know, makes sure that the building is, you know, swept and unlocked and all those things. Mm. Those things are all much more of a 501c3 that we would see more like a business. Very good hearted people working in those roles has been my experience. But there are kind of rules to how those organizations operate. And those rules are much more similar to a business or another nonprofit. And, you know, like Dave said, I was too much strategic energy too far down on the ticket. You know, like I had big ideas for change and had zero authority to get there. And even though I spent 10 years more or less eating gravel, trying to like earn my dues, by the end, I read this book. It was called Aliens in the Promised Land. It's probably on this bookshelf here behind me. And it was about why minorities struggle to achieve leadership in the evangelical church.
Wow. Wow.
And I didn't even have to make it all the way through the book. I made it through like the third chapter. And I go, holy cow, this is my life.
Wow.
And it's not to, one thing I love about this book is that it talks about racialized environments instead of racist environments, because people get, I'm sure even that's people good. Listening right now already got their hackles up going like, ugh, this makes me uncomfortable. Totally get it. But if you think about, at least the way that I experienced ministry, a lot of it was people didn't really have an imagination for somebody like me to lead. Because I remember a time really specifically where there were two of us on staff. We were young and we both got in trouble around the same time. And the one guy, the senior pastor, kind of pulls him over to the side and says, hey, you remind me a lot of myself when I was your age. You're being an idiot. You have to stop or you're never going to make it to blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And then I got the version of the talk that sounded more like, you're being an idiot. You've got to stop. There wasn't that identification piece that empathized and said, hey, totally get it. This energy, this drive is going to get you somewhere someday, but you got to harness it. You got to be disciplined, all those things, and you'll get there. And that's just, for me, it's what I found over and over and over again, both a poor gift mix, a gift mix and fit, and also just that lack of path, lack of identity of people going, yeah, that looks like who we would want to have leading us.
Yeah.
And so for me, ultimately, I just sort of felt like there wasn't a path to go further.
Wow. I love a few different things that you shared in there. And I'm probably going to forget some of them because there were so many, just a lot of nuggets that you just dropped. And it's one of the things I love about you. And you think differently. And I know you have a podcast too, which we can even point people to at the end of the show. But just the way you think about life, the way you broke down the church as the 501c3 organization of the church versus the church, which the Bible talks about the people and where we're practicing the spiritual practices and we're growing and becoming who God wants us to be. But I love the racialized environment versus versus racism. And I think that's so huge when it comes to just in general, the way we think about the environments that we're in. Because as a minority leader, you step into an environment. And the truth is, there is a little bit of a different perspective going on because of the difference in what you're bringing to the table. You know, as a young leader in what you described, not only do you have to, not only are you held to a standard based on your behavior, but because you're different and unique, there's not really a category for you. And so it can be hard to really grow and rise in your leadership position. And what was the name of that book again that you shared?
Yeah, it's called Aliens in the Promised Land. It's by Dr. Anthony Bradley.
Okay. Aliens in the Promised Land. And that's what it can feel like sometimes.
Right. I mean, like, just the title feels like. Yeah,
that's crazy. Aliens in the Promised Land, and you know, so much of it, like you said, good people. It's unintentional.
Yeah,
but when you go into an environment that's foreign, you know, as a minority leader, you're coming into a foreign environment. Those leaders there, you're kind of foreign in terms of what you bring, your skill set, your uniqueness. And so it's not for lack of, you know, good intentions. It's just there's no understanding. There's no context for what you're bringing to the table.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially too, I realize a much more now how my upbringing of a biracial background and by faith background really affected my time in ministry, because I always had a strong bent for the Great Commission, you know, for reaching all peoples, all nations. And what I didn't realize at the time was that, you know, to be honest, I didn't even really recognize that I was in majority white environments most of the time.
Yeah.
Because I mean, I went to school in West Omaha, all those things. And so it was just so normal for me to live.
And your mom was white.
Operate. Yeah. My mom was white. We lived in a white neighborhood.
Yeah.
It was more normal for me to be around white people than it was to be around non-white people.
Yeah.
And so it never occurred to me that that would be a barrier, especially again, guys like Tommy and David, they were great about, you know, giving me opportunities when I was known and, you know, deep relationship and I got into those spaces. But what I realized as I got into other churches was that people who weren't taking things like, you know, cross-cultural ministry, global missions, inner city ministry, all those things seriously, it felt like a personal attack to me because I go, hey, if there's not room for other people here, then I know there's not really room for me. Mm. I couldn't have articulated it that way at that time. That book kind of helped me to realize that that's part of what I was doing. So I know that I was putting them off a little bit too, because it's like coming in with a lot of energy going, hey, you're doing this wrong, because this environment should not be so monolithic. It should not be so similar, because this faith is not supposed to be. Yeah. And so that was really hard for me in those environments, not realizing that both the opportunities were limited, but also I was, like I said, bringing a lot of energy in a space that, if we're honest, most leaders aren't devoted to. I've heard so many times, hey, we'll focus on that stuff after we get ourselves up and running and stable, which never comes, by the way, almost never comes. It's 20, 25 years in when a pastor's trying to build a legacy by the time that stuff usually shows up. And even then, it's a pittance of what should be done. Mm.
That's good. You ever
think, I know it's spicy today,
the church consulting, man? Because it's,
you know, it's funny.
What you're saying is so prevalent.
You know, what's funny is that, so right after I got out of that world, there were several churches that asked me to consult for them. And I did so much better in those environments as a consultant, because people only hired me when they wanted to listen to me.
Yep.
As opposed to coming in at the bottom rung and going, hey, I've got some ideas. And people going, yeah, but you haven't earned it yet.
Yep.
And so just by nature of changing seats, all of a sudden people started to listen.
That's so good. Which is what I love about another thing you said earlier. You said I was too much for one church, and in terms of what you were bringing to the table, your energy, your desire to see certain change happen. And Dave, who was your leader at the time, said, you know, churches only need a dose of you. And probably that has something to do with the size of the church, the capacity of the church. I feel like I can relate to that a lot, in the sense of, you know, you want to see something happen so bad, and you have such a conviction and a passion for it, but it can be a lot for a church. And, or I would say on the other side, you want to see so much change happen that no church has the capacity to change that much or have that strong of a focus in that one specific area. And so I know personally, I feel like I can relate with that a little bit.
Yeah, well, and I feel like even you and I, you know, when we were doing work with the Bud, kind of experienced this together, where it's like, hey, here's vision for where we should go. And the thing that I realized, you know, after my days in those environments, was the speed of change is also a problem, because I may have been right on some of those diagnoses, but leaders who are in it for a long time know that change happens very slowly.
That's right.
And ultimately what I was describing, the kinds of environments that I was describing, would have to be a completely brand new start. because you know, there's this sign that I used to have. I don't think it's in this office, but it says, never try to sell a meteor to a dinosaur. It wastes your time and annoys the dinosaur. And I felt like that's what I was doing. I was trying to sell people something that would ultimately kill them, kill their organization, like break it down and rebuild it. And Christians believe that you're supposed to be open to that. That, you know, I mean, the Bible uses language like die to yourself and be reborn. But a 501c3 doesn't do that. You know, like people do that, but a 501c3 has its culture. It's got its values written up on the wall. It's got a mission statement. It's got a board, all those things. It would take more or less a complete dismantling of that environment for it to completely change. And most people do not have the appetite for that. Yeah. And I had to learn to stop blaming people for those things and just learn to start removing myself from environments that were never going to be what I needed them to
be. That's right. That's so, bro, that's so good. So good. And I think maturity says, which is what I hear you saying, it wasn't, honestly, the place you were at, the church, the environment wasn't the problem. It was you weren't the right person in the right seat to really be the one to just, you know, solely champion that. And so it wasn't that somebody was the problem. One person was right. One person was wrong. It was the revelation that, you know what, I'm probably just, I need to take some of my energy to other places, have other focuses, work with people who maybe need some of what I have, but I've got to find a seat that fully fits who I'm called to be, not me trying to make somebody else, a church, an organization, a person, become more like me. And so I think that's part of maturity.
Yeah. And I think it's a little bit, you know, one more step in maturity was realizing that it can be both at the same time.
Yeah.
There can both be grievous errors in environments, things that should be called out and are actively wrong. You know, I would argue that our racialized environments, our segregated environments in churches are not to the benefit of anyone, including those churches. So that can be wrong. And also, I cannot be the right person to bring that change, especially depending on the right seat, the right amount of energy, all those types of things. Because ultimately, one of the things I learned from those experiences was that even if I had the right idea, I was not the person that those communities wanted to get them there. And that's a hard look in the mirror to go, hey, maybe it's possible they were never going to listen to a half Indian guy because they needed to hear it from a white guy. They needed to hear it from someone that looked like them, looked like their expectation of a leader who had many years of buy-in with their community, all of those things that if that person came and said the exact same thing, that it would land harder and go farther than if I said it to them. And it would take too many scars for me to earn that in every one of those environments. And so it made way more sense for me to operate outside of those environments, speak into certain people, certain key leaders, rather than to be in one space, kind of be the Jackie Robinson of that environment and just take the beating until I earned my spot. I wasn't built for that kind of thing. And it also wouldn't do what I really feel like I'm supposed to do with my life.
So good, bro. I feel like you're counseling me right now. And you're sharing a narrative, a story, your story, but I can resonate with so many aspects of it. And I think just as minority leaders, I think there's a lot of, I would say minority leaders, entrepreneurial leaders, just leaders in general, where you're in the process of figuring out, you know, what am I willing to sacrifice in order to see something change? And is it more about me needing to change than the environment I'm in or the organization I'm a part of that needs to change? I just think that's a great paradigm and perspective. And like you said, both things can be true, but you kind of have to wrestle with and look yourself in the mirror and invite God to speak to you in terms of what your next steps and your next direction should be. One question, you know, as you talked about your journey, as I meet with young leaders, you know, everybody wants to find their thing, whether it's their business, their job, their role, their responsibility. And, you know, I've heard it said in your 20s, you try a lot of different things. Your 30s, you get a little more honed in. Your 40s, you really start to kind of get closer to that bullseye on who you're called to be. Your 50s can be, you know, some of your prime years from a leadership perspective. How do you view that, see that? Has that been more true in your life? I would say for me, that has been more true. As much as I wanted to really be dialed in, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, it really has been a process. I'm still learning, still growing, still understanding some things. But I kind of hear that in your story, you know, has that kind of been part of your journey?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot lately. We used to have a neighbor who he went to college for, I think, computer science or something like that. Even graduated a little bit early, bought his house when he was like, I don't know, 21 or something like that. Got married, had kids, all that kind of stuff. Same job for like, you know, he's not even 40. He's had the same job for like 15 years. And it's hard not to be envious of that and go, man, how did he find that path and I didn't? Right. And or a path like that. I don't even want his path necessarily, but just like that sort of security, that sort of confidence of knowing where you're supposed to go. And I think especially for entrepreneurial leaders, there is this thing where you just have to try a lot of things. There are these established path careers that you can go into, doctor, lawyer, you get the right degree, the right certification, then you're pretty much set for life. And then there are other people who are going to have to make a lot of small bets. And one of them likely will hit big eventually, but you've got to place a lot of small bets and you're going to lose a lot along the way. And you have to get good at losing to get to that spot. And so for me, you know, there was a leader who said that when you come into an organization, you have to either make all the changes that you want in the first year because you're new, there's a honeymoon period, people will give you a lot of grace, or you have to wait till year seven, till you've earned it, till you've walked through a lot of life with these people and gotten to that point. And you know, the risk of coming in hot in year one is that they'll take your head off. Mm. The risk in waiting till year seven is you might not make it there. Mm. So you kind of just have to know which type of person that you're built to be. Mm-hmm. And just know that if you lose your head several times, like, it's going to hurt and you're going to have to recover from that. And, you know, for me, like having a family was kind of a forcing function of gauging which of those bets was worth taking. You know, when I was young, took all the bets that I could. I don't really regret it. Started, you know, a photography business when I was younger, you know, did different types of ministry, did a church plant, all sorts of things. Glad that we took a lot of risks. But as soon as my first kid was born, I go, oh, it's not just me and my wife anymore. It's not just two wild, crazy kids who have capacity for risk. There's a person who's dependent on us now.
Yeah.
And it's not that we're not going to take risks anymore. It's that we're going to measure every risk better. And, you know, one other thing that I learned during that time was that it's not so much that you're looking for the right exact job. I think more what you're looking for is the right way of working. Because
that's good.
Photography and brand strategy and writing a book now, all are actually very similar ways of working. In fact, a couple of years ago, I had a hand in planning my high school's 20th reunion. And that was actually a very similar process as well. I sort of ended up the co-chair of this thing. I didn't even really love high school all that much. So I wasn't somebody who was like, yeah, best years of my life, whatever, let's relive it. I was just like, oh, I know how to do this type of work. I know how to brand an event. I know how to get the word out. I know how to see what people's preferences are. All those things to put on a successful event. And it was great. So it's more about finding the way of working rather than necessarily the specific thing that you're doing.
That's good. That's good. I think that's a really good word. And for you, as you kind of went down that journey, it led you to Fruitful. And it led you to understanding how you like to work and how you're designed to add value to whatever environment you're in. And Fruitful is a design company. You can describe Fruitful a little bit, but your focus is more on the strategic side. And so bringing kind of more your strategic nature to this organization that helps with brand and identity and storytelling. And I know you guys are connected to Story Brand and are certified Story Brand ambassadors, and you're able to teach that and take companies through that process. But talk a little bit about Fruitful and just kind of your overall model as a company.
Yeah. So we are a design and strategy company, as Josh said. We focus mainly on branding, messaging, and websites. And as you mentioned, we're a Story Brand certified agency, one of about 30 in the world. What that means is that we use the power of story to help position your customer as the hero of the story and position you as the guide to their success. Most marketing companies will come in, story's a hot word, they'll come in and say, hey, we want to help you tell your story. I always tell even potential clients, if somebody comes and says they want to help you tell their story, your story, run away. Because you want to know your customer story and talk about how you enter your customer story as a guide. Because nobody wakes up in the morning thinking about how they're going to make your nonprofit better or how they're going to make your business money. One of my favorite statistics in all business is, and this was true several years ago, I don't know if it's still true, but Target's top 10% of customers account for 50% of their revenue.
Yeah.
Top 10% accounts for half of their revenue. And the funny thing is, every time I tell that story, every room I'm ever in, somebody goes, I think I'm in that top 10%. Because we all like spend so much money at Target. We go there for one thing. We end up buying that Joanna Gaines pillow thing that costs too much money. And we go, man, I spent all my money at Target. Even with that, not a single person who doesn't work at Target or own Target wakes up in the morning and goes, gosh, how can I give my money to Target today? They all think about things like, how can I be a good parent today? How can I get that thing done at work? How can I make that sale? They're thinking about their own story, advancing their own life. And if there's a place where Target enters into that, how can I be a good parent? Well, my kids need clothes. My kids need diapers. My kid needs food. So Target needs to be a part of that, but does not mean that I wake up at all thinking about, gosh, I hope the Target stock price goes up. And that's the difference between being a guide to their success and then you saying that you're the hero. If Target put out a thing that said, we had record profits this year, all of us would probably go, ugh. You know, we kind of be like, I know that you make profit, but I actually don't really want to hear about it.
Right.
But so many companies do that. They talk about how they're best in Omaha. They talk about, you know, all those things. And those things are fine as a proof point, but you don't want to start with them. You want to start with, I know what you're going through, and here's how I'm going to help you get to where you want to be. It's going to be so much more effective.
Wow.
That's the position we take as a company is helping you enter your customer story as a guide and let them be the hero.
I love that. I feel like we went through the process with you guys. I don't know if it was 5-6 years ago. And I'm still understanding that kind of story brand positioning process better and better as we continue to move forward. And the idea of being a guide and who the heroes are and making sure that our story is really their story and how it aligns with who they are and what they're going through. And so for me, it's an ongoing process. So to have people from the outside come in with fresh eyes to help bring some perspective, some clarity to some things, I know really helped us think through a lot of what we were doing. And we shifted our story and how we started to tell our story and started to kind of share our brand. What are the types of brands that you really, or organizations or people that you really enjoy working with as you take people through this process?
Yeah. So right now we're doing this thing called 30-day brand sprints. And that's where we help people get their brand. So your logo, your brand guidelines, all those things, your messaging and your website all set up within 30 days. And yes, that sounds like a lot, and it is. We spend two intensive days with people going through the story brand process, going through your brand discovery, going through your website discovery, so that then we can just get to work hard for you. We only do one of those a month for one client, and so clients who are interested in that, first of all, are ideal clients for us. typically these are often service-based businesses because people who are doing e-commerce or, you know, need really complicated stores or those types of things aren't going to be necessarily interested in tearing down, putting up a whole store back again in 30 days. May not have the capacity to do that as an organization.
Yeah.
We will still do those types of projects, but it takes just a longer term. But the people who are either starting something new and are ready to invest in it, you know, there's the old adage in service work that says you can have it fast, cheap, or good, and you can pick two of those things. And so we've optimized for fast and really good. Ben and I have been doing this for 10 years. I really enjoy the work that we're doing. You get direct access to both owners. So it's fast and good, but it is an investment. Mm-hmm. And so people who are able to recognize that supercharging our brand and our messaging in this way can have a 10x return on what they're investing, those are the people who are going to do well to work with us and that we love showing outsized results for.
I love that. 30 days is a sprint, no doubt. I've gone through some of that process before, but there's something powerful about this idea of immersion and really getting in there and having kind of a short window of time to get it done. And then I just know with your strategic nature and Ben, your co-owner, his design, his creativity, and then all the other individuals that are a part of your team. I mean, you guys really bring that holistic ability to help really develop out a story in a brand, which is powerful. I'd love to shift to a project that you're just kind of finishing up and are starting to, I would say, release to the world, the book that you wrote called The Caring House. And talk about that again. You talk about, come on, we got a picture of it right there. My copy is not in yet. And
not yet.
Not yet, but it's on its way. And I'm looking forward to diving into it. But earlier, you know, you talked about finding not just the right workplace, but how you work. And so you've been working on this project for a while. Describe the book, describe your heart behind it, and even the process to getting it completed and now released.
Yeah. So about 9 years ago, I was driving down to Fruitful. I was listening to an episode of This American Life, and they talked about this grief counseling center for children in Salt Lake City. And my wife and I, we had been part of a church plant in Salt Lake City, and we actually lived in the exact neighborhood where this grief counseling center for kids was based. And so I was just kind of blown away by the stories. About 60% of the kids there have lost a dad. Wow. And unfortunately, about 20% of the kids have lost a dad to suicide. Mm. For me, it had this immediate kind of effect of going, man, what if a little boy and a little girl met there, both having lost a dad to suicide, and they grew up, they stayed connected, they fell in love, got married. With as difficult as marriage is, could two people survive that constant suspicion that today might be the last day that you have with your partner?
Wow.
Could you survive that fear that one or both of you is going to become like your parents? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't realize it at the time, but our marriage started with a sudden loss. My wife's sister unfortunately passed, to an overdose about 6 months after we got married. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that kind of cast a shadow over our first year of marriage. And so we learned a lot about grief in that process. But then, you know, multiple jobs, you know, transitions and, you know, some of them lost and ugly situations. We had two miscarriages, before we had healthy kids born. And then the year that I started writing the book, I lost two friends who were in their 30s like me. Mm-hmm. And they both had kids. And I think I was just feeling the weight of the world a little bit, you know, feeling... Wow. Like, man, how does anybody make it through all of this? This is so hard. And so I started this book. Again, it was a lot of it was this idea of, you know, what if two people met in the circumstance and could they make it? But part of what I was asking is like, can I make it? Can we make it? Are we all good? And I don't mean, you know, I don't mean, can I be faithful to my wife and all that kind of stuff? But just like, how does anybody make it through this thing? It's so hard. And so I knew I wasn't writing a tragedy. I'll kind of spoil that part of the book just outright, is that I wanted to write a book that just kind of asked the question, like, can we find hope even in the darkest of places?
Wow. That's so good, bro. And you started that kind of journey 9 years ago.
Yeah.
And you talk about, you know, just that process of writing while you're working, some of the personal experiences that you've had. Talk about the style of writing, because you share it's a story, you know, with probably principles in it. But talk about just kind of your heart and just even your creative side coming out in this book.
Yeah. You know, so one of the things that's interesting about the style of the book is because I do creative work for a living, and that's all kind of work for hire. You know, it's like I worked for you. I worked for Bite. I worked for First National Bank for Children's, you know, for all our company has worked for those people. And in all those places, there are rules. I have to follow, you know, not only have to, but get to enter in, help people refine their voice, write with that voice, speak with that voice, but it's theirs. It's not mine. Yep. And so on this process, I just allowed myself to kind of take the governor off and go, if I were to write a thing that's really honest, what does it sound like? And you know, part of the reason it took 9 years was because some of the personal work of it was just going like, hey, I used to be a pastor, but there are swear words in this book, you know, and just going like the really honest, difficult, brutal struggle of like that question of can we make it?
Yeah.
Is rough sometimes, and it's raw and it's real. And you know, I love the main character, Gabe. You know, too many people read me directly into the character if they know me. I'm looking forward to people who don't know me reading this, because he's different from me. We have some similarities, of course, but but he's different from me. In fact, I like to say that he's like the unfiltered version of me. Like, he is so sarcastic sometimes because he's been through so much, and he's using humor as such a huge defense. And you know, so the book has a lot of humor in it. Some of it's a little bit dark, you know, but it's what you would imagine from people who have seen the worst of what life has to offer and just have a chip on their shoulder going, prove it to me. Prove it to me that life is worth living. Prove it to me that any of this matters. So it's a, you know, it's kind of a edgier sense of humor than I necessarily allow myself to have in public. And so, you know, the style of it is, it's written from first person. It's very, you know, you get to see behind his eyes. You get to see how he's experiencing all of this. And there were a couple of parts of my editor was like, I don't know if you can say that. And it's like, well, that's the point, actually. Like, you know, some of the uglier thoughts that he has, some of the uglier thoughts that his wife Jenny has in the book, those are the real things that people say behind closed doors, that that people ask, that people judge, even though they shouldn't, all of those things. And I wanted to make these characters as real as possible. And so part of it took a little bit of reckoning for me of going, I know this won't fit in with a lot of Christians. There's no scene where somebody goes and prays in the chapel and, you know, they receive Jesus and everything works out for them. This is a lot more like, you know, if I could compare myself to Flannery O'Connor or C.S. Lewis or any of those folks who use the story itself to go, is the nature of reality redemptive and hopeful? Not, you know, specifically chapter and verse and pray this prayer and all those things, but instead just like, are we living in a story that's bleak, or are we living in a story that's hopeful? And that's what this book is. It's not meant to be prescriptive necessarily for follow these steps and it'll all work out great for you. Instead, it's we're going to go to the darkest place and we're going to see if there's still any hope down there.
Wow. Wow. So good, bro. So good. What's your ultimate hope for this book as people read it? I know even, you know, the pre-order sales, the proceeds are going to the center in Salt Lake City. But like, what's your hope that this book would accomplish?
You know, I was thinking about that today, and you know how when you're sad, listening to a sad song actually makes you feel better.
Mm.
My hope for this book is that people who feel the weight of the world will feel hopeful by reading this book.
Mm.
And so if you're somebody who like life is roses all the time, you might be like, why did somebody write such a serious book? It may not be for you. It may not be for all of my, you know, or some of my former church friends. But if you're somebody who goes, man, it's been a lot. It's been a lot since Trayvon. It's been a lot since Ferguson. It's been a lot since COVID. It's been, you know, all of those things. If you go, it's been a lot. And I just want to read something that feels like the way that you feel better after listening to a sad song, that kind of counterintuitive, I'm going to go down to go up sort of thing. That's my ultimate hope for this book. I would love, honestly, if, you know, Apple or somebody picked up the movie rights to it eventually. I'd love to adapt this into a screenplay, because I think we need to tell these kinds of stories. I think we need to look into the places that we're a little bit afraid of. Mm. I had a friend who texted me in the middle of the book, and she goes, you know, this thing just happened, and I'm afraid to read further because it reminds me of this thing that happened to me. And she's like, but I know that you're going to take me somewhere good. And that's really what I want people to experience. And I want as many people to experience that as possible.
Come on, man. The Caring House. Powerful piece. A lot of 9 years of investment that go into putting this piece of art, this book together and out there into the world, which I know is even just a vulnerable place to be when you've poured so much into it and now you're sharing it with so many different people. If people want to get a copy, where's the best place to go and purchase a copy of the book?
Yeah. So if you go to rajlulla.com, RAJLULLA.com, then that's really, there's like a bunch of buttons on that site. You can hit any of them that say get the book, and they'll take you to Amazon. It's only available on Amazon right now because about 80% of the books in the US are sold there. And I want to make sure that the most people have the opportunity to find this book. I will start releasing in other places after the launch on March 26th. But if you want to help kids who are going through the loss of a loved one, all the pre-order sales will be donated to the nonprofit that this book is based on. And so please pre-order on Amazon. That is going to make a difference both for other people finding the book and in the lives of these kids.
Come on, man. Raj Lulla. Check out the website. Get a copy of the book, The Caring House. Check out Fruitful Design. What's the website, Fruitful Design?
It's fruitful.design. We made it as easy as possible.
Come on, man. I can remember that. Fruitful.design. Social media handles. Check them out. They got a podcast. I know he and co-owner Ben do together. Great insight, perspective on all things story, design, strategy, life. And so check them out. Raj, thanks so much, bro, for just taking time to share your story, to talk about the book, your journey as a leader. I feel like even just this conversation, it, like you said, you know, not necessarily all descriptive prescriptive in different ways, but a lot of insights, a lot of great perspective. And I hope as people listen to this, they get to pull out different nuggets that apply to them and continue to follow you on your journey and be a part of the story that you're telling. So just appreciate you, man. Thanks for all that you do. And thanks for spending some time with us today.
Yeah, thanks, Josh.
Well, hey, thanks again for listening to today's episode on Game Changer, a performance podcast. And look forward to being with you again. Check out our previous episodes if you want to hear other stories of leaders, individuals who are using their influence to impact the world around them, and continue to pursue and press into the game changer calling that God has in your life. We'll see you next time.